Hello and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. My name is Bob Bamber and we're going to jump back in the time machine to September of 1993. I'm being joined by Colin Judkins.
Hello.
And Craig Wilson.
Alrighty.
And we will start with the news. Colin, kick us off.
Okay. Big news, WWF Intercontinental Champion Shawn Michaels has quit the company this month. Sources close to him have suggested that he's been unhappy with the promotion. It's caused a little bit of weight gain and some other issues. As we are speaking now, Titan have refused to give him his release, which means he is not able to work for other companies. A 20-man tournament was held at the last set of TV tapings to determine the next Intercontinental Champion.
And sticking with WWF, the tag team titles were taken off the Steiners on the 12th of September edition of Raw when they were beaten by the Quebecers. The switch comes with Scott reportedly being suspended for 2 months, and if the team choose to stay with the company, they would be in line for a return around about the time of the Survivor Series at the end of November.
Also, we skip over to WCW, and the National Wrestling Alliance are no longer associated with the company. The NWA Heavyweight Championship, which goes all the way back to the early 40s, which has been with WCW since 1987, seems to now be billed as the World Heavyweight title, referred to that by Michael Buffer at Fall Brawl. The legal breakup is ongoing. It is complicated by the fact that WCW own the physical championship belt that Rick Rude now holds.
WCW held Fall Brawl this month with three title changes taking place at the event. Lord Steven Regal even beat Ricky Steamboat for the TV title thanks to help from St. William. In the tag team title match, the referee was distracted when Paul Roma of the Horsemen appeared to have the match won, ensuring that the Nasty Boys ended up winning the tag titles. And the NWA title was won by Rick Rude, who used brass knuckles to knock out Ric Flair when the referee's back was turned. And in the main event, the faces of the Shockmaster, who we discussed in some detail last month, Davey Boy Smith, Sting and Dustin Rhodes, defeated the heel team of Sid Vader in Harlem Heat when Kane of Harlem Heat submitted to the bear hug of the Shockmaster.
If we go now to Eastern Championship Wrestling, Ultra Clash was held this past month in Philadelphia, which saw Shane Douglas defeat the Sandman to retain the ECW title. Elsewhere, we saw Terry Funk teaming with Stan Hansen to defeat the team of Abdullah the Butcher and Kevin Sullivan when Eddie Gilbert hit Terry Funk in the head for a DQ in a no DQ match. You go figure that one. To the surprise of nobody, Funk, Sullivan and Abdullah the Butcher all juice during the match. We also saw Dark Patriot defeat JT Smith in a scaffold match.
Sticking with ECW, owner Todd Gordon and booker Eddie Gilbert have severed ties, the breakup happening around a week before Ultra Clash, and it is rumoured that it was Paul Heyman that booked the Ultra Clash event.
Head back to WCW, and Dustin Rhodes, the son of the American Dream, who's been with the company since 1991, is reportedly being the person picked in the WCW to unify the old NWA World title and the new WCW World Championship.
And continuing with the theme of WCW, Sid Vicious walked out of WCW tapings earlier this month, reportedly because he refused to take a drug test, which is little wonder considering how well he stayed in character after the Shockmaster's debut. Vicious asked for the test to be administered 2 weeks later, but WCW refused this, so he allegedly quit. Since then, he has returned to the company and wrestled at Fall Brawl, but the feeling is that WCW is going to let him go with it given his position near the top of the WCW card.
And that will wrap up the news for this week. We're going to start by discussing WCW Fall Brawl. Colin, as always, can you kick us off with the results?
I can indeed. Lord Steven Regal defeated Ricky Steamboat to win the WCW World Television Championship. Charlie Norris defeated Big Sky. Too Cold Scorpio and Marcus Bagwell defeated The Equalizer and Paul Orndorff. Ice Train defeated Shanghai Pierce. The Nasty Boys defeated Arn Anderson and Paul Roma to win the WCW World Tag Team Championships. Cactus Jack defeated Yoshi Kwan. Rick Rude defeated Ric Flair to become the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. And the team of Sting, Davey Boy Smith, Dustin Rhodes, and the Shockmaster defeated Sid Vicious, Vader, Harlem Heat to win War Games.
And thank you for that. Craig, just kick us off with your general thoughts on War Games and the football show as a whole.
Yeah, no problem. It was a little bit disappointing in comparison to last year, as we had the Paulie Dangerously's Dangerous Alliance versus Sting's Quadron in the main event, which just seemed a little bit more solid, and we didn't have three title changes that were largely owing to a scrappy finish, which just sort of undermined slightly the whole pay-per-view, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're completely right in the sense that I think my overall thoughts on the show were there was, yeah, I mean, Nasty Boys in a 24-minute match is, you know, questionable to say the least. But I think, you know, there was three good world title, not world title matches, but three good title matches on the show, and they all ended with screwy finishes. And I think, you know, you can do one if it makes storyline sense, but don't do three. Craig, we'll start with the TV title match between Lord Steven Regal and Ricky Steamboat. I think from these two, given, you know, their reputations, I think we got the kind of match that you might expect. But as I say, again, just a soft finish and a crowd that was pretty flat for it.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right. It's totally a sort of what you would expect from these two guys. If you were to plan out this match, it's Regal versus Steamboat by numbers, but it was a good match, and in my opinion, it's the best match of the evening, but it was just such a screwy finish. But the match seemed to just do quite well, and it was fine, and then it just ended in such a bad fashion. And like you've already pointed out, one match with a screwy finish is fine, but three just seems a little bit excessive.
Moving on to the tag team title match, as I say, the Nasty Boys in a 24-minute match for me is overkill. Not in the sense that you can't have a 24-minute match, but I think particularly Nasty Boys with Paul Roma, who I don't think is capable of that kind of match either. I mean, Arn Anderson certainly is, but I just thought this match went on too long. I don't think they told a great story with it, and again, push comes to shove, there's a referee distraction and the match is over.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Nasty Boys in a 24-minute match, you could conceivably argue that that's about 15, 20 minutes too long, and Paul Roma, you have a guy that was a WWF jobber, but the match wasn't totally terrible, perhaps slightly too long, as you point out, but it's a screwy ending that again damages this one. I mean, it wasn't too bad. I mean, you give 24 minutes to the Nasty Boys, and you don't expect, you're not expecting a Flair versus Steamboat classic, but they can do okay. But it was just the ending again that really, really, really damaged this one.
And the, well, whatever we're going to call it, wrestling's heavyweight championship match, as Michael Buffer announced it as, the Ric Flair, Rick Rude title match. I think one to point out Rick Rude's quite brilliant trunks, with Fifi, who was Ric Flair's valet. Fifi was just kind of plastered all over them, which I just thought was tremendous in its effort, and it's just pure arrogance of the Rude character. But again, I think a good match, not great. And again, it's a 30-minute Flair match. There was one, I think, last month with Sting on WCW Saturday Night. It was a good match. And again, a screwy finish, which just, with this time it was Rick Rude using the brass knuckles on Ric Flair with Fifi distracting the referee. And again, Craig, we're sat here just saying the same thing again.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Another screwy finish. I think the thing that's worth pointing out here is the fact that you've got your Rick Rude in these in the trunks. You mentioned the trunks, and they're absolutely fantastic. But it is just a play on his trunks during his feud with Jake Roberts when he had, was it Cheryl Roberts? Am I right in getting Jake Roberts' ex-wife name correct? But he had her on her trunks. It's just, it's a play on that, but yep, no, it's absolutely brilliant. But again, whatever brilliance they play up, it is undone by the fact that it's another unclean finish.
Yeah, and it's strange booking because it's, you know, there were all titles that were going to heels, and so I guess you could say, well, you know, traditionally, often in case of wrestling, to put a title on a heel, you have a screwy finish. But I guess the question is then, why book three of them? You know, you put this, in theory, far enough in advance with the WCW Worldwide tapings that you would think that they might have planned this a bit better, not to have all of these three aligned on the same night. But again, it was three good matches capped off by that. We'll move on, Craig, to the War Games match. And I know that we were speaking in the production meeting beforehand just about the War Games match last year and just about how good that was. And the kind of feeling that the War Games format is such that you can put kind of any different range of elements in and it will create a good match. But I think this is the proof that that statement isn't true. And this, as War Games matches go, was fairly poor.
You're absolutely right. The 92 War Games match with Polly Dangerously's Dangerous Alliance against Sting Squadron is probably the best War Games match to date. And the 91 War Games was the first video that I purchased, so I have a special affinity to that. But when you compare both of those to this one, it's just lacking. And it's not as if you've got a bad group of talent in there. I mean, you've got Sting, who's the top WCW guy in terms of face. You've got Vader, who's the top heel, and probably one of the top heels in the world at this stage. And you've got Vicious, who's up there in terms of a heel. You've got
Davey Boy, who was main eventing SummerSlam, you know, last year.
And the Shockmaster, who got a great debut. Yeah, no, you've got a great team of faces against a great team of heels, but it just didn't seem to click. I mean, it just seemed like there was something missing. I mean, when you look back, you've got some great moments in War Games history. You've got LOD injuring unintentionally, I guess, but it made for a great spectacle. Them Doomsday and Device in J.J. Dillon. You had 91, you had Sid Vicious powerbombing Brian Pillman and his head connecting with the top of the cage and injuring himself. War Games, until including 1992, was just awesome because it was just totally unlike anything else. It stood apart from what you had in the WWF. It was just a great main event, and then you just take it to 1993 and you've got the Shockmaster, who debuted so dreadfully, defeating one of the members of Harlem Heat with a bear hug. It just seems light and day difference in terms of the impact that would have. And I think that hurt the main event. It just seemed really weak in comparison to what had gone before it.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like they booked this finish without... we're talking about, you know, obviously the worldwide tapings with they're going to book stuff 3 or 4 months in advance and come what may. It almost feels like this was recorded back in June then as well, because the Shockmaster, all right, there was no Stormtrooper helmet this time. It was a builder's helmet. And I know, Craig, you compared it to him auditioning for the Village People, which I'm not sure whether that's better or worse than the original incarnation of the Shockmaster, but it's almost like they booked this with the original Shockmaster character in mind, because there just wasn't that feeling that, wow, this is a big moment, you know. And as you said, the bear hug, and there's just the bizarre finish where I think he's got Kane in the bear hug from Harlem Heat, and Cole stood in the corner kind of one of the rings, kind of just brawling with Davey Boy Smith. Not really, they're just exchanging punches, just kind of sort of off camera. And you can see Cole looking at Kane in this, and you're thinking, right, interfere. And he didn't.
Yep.
And so Kane taps out, and that's it. And I just thought it was a really soft ending. And maybe it's just because I'm looking at two small sample size, but I don't think this was, I think this was a case of, this is a War Games format just not working, in the sense that you've got all of this kind of slow build up. Let's have, you know, 2 minutes or whatever between each entrant. Everything build up, and they didn't really build a story around it. And then all of that, Colin, to one finish. Is that, am I just looking at one War Games match in isolation and looking at a bad example, or do you think there's more to that in terms of the format maybe could do with tweaking, or does it work?
Well, I think that WCW always looks to put big star names into their War Games matches, and the guys are always, they're pretty big. I mean, if you look at LOD, you've got Sid Vicious, you've now got the Shockmaster. He's not tall, but he's a big guy. I don't think the War Games cage is big enough. I think it should be a couple of feet maybe taller, because, I mean, it just doesn't look like they have enough space for these really big guys to do any of their big moves.
Greg?
I think you're absolutely right. You look back through the history of the War Games, you saw LOD injuring J.J. Dillon with a botched doomsday device, and you had Sid Vicious attempting to powerbomb Pillman in 1991 and injuring him. It's not as if they're limited to this space. I just don't understand why the cage that they have is the size it is, but it's led to injuries. And Colin's right, it just seems to just limited what the wrestlers are able to do in that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, in terms of the way the match was put together, I mean, there was the thing with, well, the Road Warriors out kind of leading the team, and then, you know, we talked about in the news, Dustin Rhodes kind of possibly, you know, breaking out, and there's the whole thing where he kind of rebelled against the rule and said, no, I'm going in first, which I thought was quite nice. But on the whole, I just thought it was quite a flat match, and again, I'd say maybe it's just the wrong sample, but in terms of, you know, I mean, there was a nice spot in the match where I think it was Kane from Harlem Heat who did a flying shoulder tackle from one ring to the other, but I kind of felt, and Craig, we can talk about this more generally, in terms of, obviously, there's a two-ring setup for the main event, but these are also present for all of the other matches on the card. Obviously, you can't build a ring in such a small, short space of time. In terms of, one, from an arena's perspective, and two, from a person's perspective watching at home, how did the two-ring format come across?
It just seems a little bit over the top. I mean, I like the idea that you've got something that's a little bit different to what you would normally consider your wrestling match. You wouldn't see two rings normally, but if you were behind the commentary booth and the match was taking place in the far away ring of the two, then I can't help think that you'd be a little bit disappointed by that. So it seems sort of slightly counterproductive as far as I'm concerned.
And in terms of from watching on the TV, do you think they made enough use of in the other matches? Because they're basically the matches alternated from ring to ring for each match. Do you think there maybe was an opportunity for a spot where in one of the matches where they kind of spilled between the two rings? I mean, tried some unique stuff using the kind of like the sets of ropes back to back and the bridge between the rings?
I think Sting has tried it for numerous years, that he's done the ring-to-ring, over-the-top rope, sort of shoulder charge, etc. But it does seem like an awful lot of effort and limiting the amount of ringside action that you can have. I mean, does it adding an additional ring, does that not just take out a whole front row of the ring? I mean, I don't want to sound like your sort of corporate Vince McMahon lackey, but I mean, if he was to be convinced of having two rings, would the main thing he would not that would jump out for him, would it not be a case of two rings? Does that not eliminate the front row of the crowd?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. And, you know, again, as you say, I think one of the positive things we can say is that it does make it feel different, in the sense that, you know, the War Games match two rings is something special that if you only visit every now and then, maybe once a year, you can say, yeah, this is a big event, there's two rings, it's memorable. But I don't think that came across. I mean, we'll do kind of full-on wrap-ups in a sec. I mean, I thought, as we said, you know, the three title matches to all end with screw finishes for me was just a very bad move. I know you've already booked all this stuff in advance and you've got three face-to-heel title changes, but it was like, at least have one of them that was like something tangible. We can go, wow, that was a good match. And I think that's what this show really lacked, was that one match that you can hang your hat on and go, that's what propped up this card. The rest of the show, I could take or leave, really. Some of the matches in the middle of the card really weren't of any note. I actually thought one of the bigger highlights of the show, I think, was Cactus Jack, who, you know, came back and they did a kind of a highlight package of his feud with Vader, which I assume is going to be the main event of Halloween Havoc next month. And they did revisit the mini movies, which I thought was strange given that, much like Cactus Jack's supposed memory loss, I was hoping I'd never have to see them again. But after that, we got a Cactus Jack promo, which I thought was the highlight of the show, probably along with Two Cold Scorpio's 450 Splash. And there's a great line in the middle of it. Cactus Jack said, if you can get arrested for the thoughts in your head, then get a rope and hang me now. And I thought, that's such a good line. And in amongst the rest of the show, and I kind of felt like, well, if that's the highlight, then that's probably where we're at. Craig, your final thoughts on this show and a score for it before we move on?
It's a little bit disappointing that this show followed on from last month's Clash of the Champions. You know, I was very positive about that event. I thought it was a lot better than SummerSlam, and it's just a shame that the company followed that up with this pay-per-view. So I'd maybe give that a 5 at best. It just seemed like a WCW Worldwide taping at best.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was probably a bit more down on the show than you were. I would not recommend this show to go back and watch. I don't think there was... I think you could accept some of the elements on this card if there was one gun match. If Rude and Flair was maybe better, you could go, that's what you can stamp your hat on. But for a 30-minute Ric Flair match, I don't think that was as good as it could have been. I'm giving it a 3 out of 10. As I say, just too many screwy finishes and a War Games match that I think was just a letdown. And that'll wrap up our discussion of that part. Colin, we'll move on to some WWF news. It's been a relatively quiet month in WWF. Only 3 episodes of Raw. No big pay-per-view event coming up. It's Survivor Series next in November. We've got them. But as we touched on the news, the two big stories are the departure of Shawn Michaels that we'll come on to in a little bit, but the reported suspension of the Steiner brothers and the tag team titles going on to the Quebecers.
Yeah, I mean, the suspension of the Steiner brothers is a massive blow, not only to the WWF's tag team division, but I think the WWF in a whole. You can argue that the best parts of the WWF product the last couple of months have been Steiner Brothers matches. The suspensions just come from nowhere, as did the title change on Raw, with the Quebecers seemingly elevated to the level almost instantaneously, because they needed to have the tag titles on TV while Scott Steiner is suspended. I can understand why they need that, but I think maybe there might have been some better choices other than the Quebecers, people that had already been on TV, maybe. But I'm willing to give them a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Colin, I agree with you in the sense that, for me, you know, a lot of the work, and I spoke about this on the podcast last time, but a lot of the work in terms of the better in-ring action of the WWF has been down to the Steiner brothers. You look at their cage match against Money Inc., their match at SummerSlam against the Heavenly Bodies. You know, those two really good matches. And I think at a time when your headline feud is Yokozuna and Lex Luger, two guys who aren't very good wrestlers, I think we saw at SummerSlam probably as good a match out of those two as we're going to get. And so quite what they're going to do for their follow-up, I'm not sure. But at a time like that, you need your guys bubbling under further down the card who can make you go, well, we can just about have Luger and Yokozuna at the top of the card because we've got Bang 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 in the middle of the show. And Bang 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 probably is the Steiner brothers and Shawn Michaels. I mean, Craig, to look at this from the TV perspective before we look at the possible behind the scenes, not that we know a tremendous amount about why Scott was being suspended, it was, to me, a bit bizarre because... Yeah, we got, they came back from Raw, I think on September 12th. There's a break in between the pay-per-view and Raw. And the first thing was, oh, the Stars have defended their tag team titles against the Quebecers. Now, okay, the Quebecers have been around for a bit, but they've not really been on Raw very much recently. So it's like, to the Raw audience who doesn't watch very WWF Mania or Superstars, they go, well, one, maybe who are these guys? Or two, what have they done to earn a title shot? Then there was the whole thing about all these Quebecer rules, and not just one, there's like six. It was like, if it's a DQ, the Quebecers win the titles. If it's a count out, the Quebecers win the titles. If Scott uses a pile driver, the Quebecers win the titles. If there's any weapons, the Quebecers win the titles. All these different stipulations, and you can sort of understand from, well, God, we're in a bit of a ruck. We've got to try and find a way of getting the titles off the Steiners and protect them, because, you know, as we said, they're one of their better acts. Craig, in terms of how the title change came about on TV, it all looks a bit strange.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we discussed earlier the idea of we were sort of starved for great in-ring action this month. But I thought the Steiners and the Quebecers stuff was good. I mean, we had the Quebec rules. I'm sure it was sort of stacked favourably in the Quebecers' favour and we had the title change as per, but it was good, and it just, I don't know, it just seems a little bit like you're left wanting a little bit more. And I mean, that's good for the tag team titles, but it's, you've not got the strength in the division there, so it is a bit of a shame that the Steiners lose the titles. It's you want them to win, you want them to be involved in the tag team title picture, but I don't know. It's just I want the Steiners are a little bit different from every other tag team that's been in the WWE for a long time, and I mean, I'm a huge tag team wrestling fan, and they sort of stand out, so you want them to be a little bit strong. And it's, I mean, I totally understand the position that WWF are in, but I don't know, you want the Steiners to be the strong tag team there.
Craig, your thoughts on the Quebecers? Are they, if the Steiners aren't available, are they the best option? Are they a good option going forward?
It's difficult to think of anyone better. I mean, it's got to be either them or the head shrinkers, hasn't it? I mean, the fact that the Quebecers have been at the forefront of the WWF latest television, that puts them in the strongest position. I think the head shrinkers, hand on heart, are the better of the two tag teams. But the idea that it's the Quebecers that the WWF are putting their weight behind, I think it's inevitable that it's that you've got to see them as the Quebecers, sorry, as the stronger team.
Colin?
I agree with Craig. I think the head shrinkers might have been a better option to go with, but I think the WWF needed a tag team that could vocally tell a story that would let people think they're okay, they can take the titles off of the Steiners. The head shrinkers aren't going to do that with Arthur as their manager. I mean, they could pull some faces and headbutt each other a couple of times, and that'd be about it. You've got Rougeau and Pierre. Pierre doesn't really talk, but Rougeau can talk. You've also got Johnny Polo. You know, they're a good heel tag team in the sense that they can incite a crowd, they can incite the face team. So, yeah, I'd probably say that they are the better option in story-wise.
Colin, moving on to the other departure, I spoke about, you know, work rate and having, you know, good workers in the middle of your card. I don't think there is a guy who ticks the box any more in that regard than Shawn Michaels. I think there's certainly an argument to say he's one of the best, if not the best, in-ring workers in North America right now. And obviously we don't have much story regarding his departure. We covered what we know in the news. But in terms of Shawn Michaels' departure, I mean, I think just the fact that he left with the title. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, they're going to, as Jack Tunney explained on TV at least, they're going to have a 20-man tournament to crown a new champion, and Shawn Michaels is quote-unquote suspended. But in terms of Michaels' position on the card, how big a miss would he be, Colin?
Shawn Michaels is an absolutely fantastic performer. Ton of potential. A type of guy that some of the faces higher up the card would love to work with, because the guy bumps like a trooper. He to a point oversells stuff to the makes other people's moves look a hell of a lot better than they actually are. That said, though, even as Intercontinental Champion, I think he's a really good heel. He's the smarmy guy that thinks all the ladies love him. I think he works really well as a character. But again, as an in-ring performer, he's absolutely fantastic and will be a huge miss to the WWF mid-card.
Craig?
Absolutely. I mean, we talked the idea of the Intercontinental Champion being the Workers' Champion, and Shawn Michaels embodies that more than anyone. And it's just, it's a loss to that division when they could build that up to being the, I guess, if you look at the house show thing, the whole sort of Michaels headlines, the B show against, I don't know, Matty Jannetty, maybe Razor Ramon, and some great IC title matches is on the, whereas on the A level shows, you've got Yokozuna against Bret Hart and stuff. And if you look at the two of those, the idea that Michaels versus X or Y is probably going to be the better match, and that's a loss to the company. Certainly on the house show circuit, is Raw is still getting off the ground. I mean, I think Raw is going to be a huge money-making venture for the company, but at the moment the money is to be made in the house show circuit. So if the B show features our main event, putting the IC champion when it's Shawn Michaels against a great worker such as, you know, a Razor Ramon, Marty Jannetty or so, then that's going to be a big draw, and that's where the money's going to be. So him being out with the company is going to be a big loss for Vince McMahon and the coffers.
Yeah, and for what it's worth as well, you know, that Diesel debuted not that long ago as Shawn Michaels' kind of bodyguard or enforcer or whatever you want to call him, coming over from WCW. And also, you know, with Shawn gone, I don't know what happens to the Diesel character. Colin, this may be pie in the sky thinking, but is there a thought maybe of Shawn Michaels going to WCW? I mean, I guess that you might think, and if so, would he fit in, and where in the card would he fit in?
Well, he's certainly a good enough worker to warrant a spot on the WCW roster. It's come out, him wanting to leave the WWF's come out of the blue. Maybe WCW have got in his ear and offered him a very good financial package, which has prompted all of the, I want to leave, let me out of my contract. So WWF are refusing. They won't let him go because I would guess that they are worried that he could end up on WCW programming. And even more so, he'd be the unbeaten Intercontinental Champion, which is a huge title in the WWF, and the WCW would love to have a guy who is an unbeaten champion from their rival promotion.
Craig?
I think Colin's absolutely right. I mean, the idea of Michaels has got to be a huge draw for WCW, and we've all seen recently that they're recording their shows over a short period of time, so it's got to be less dates for him. But I mean, anyone that sees himself as a serious sort of guy in the profession of wrestling has got to see WWF as a better bet than the WCW.
I don't think Shawn Michaels' size would help him in WCW. I can't see him being a US champion or a world champion. You think of the guys that hold those titles, your Vaders, your Stings.
Sid Vicious.
He is not at that level, and I don't think he would be able to break into that upper echelon of the WCW.
By not at that level, are we talking purely physically, or are we talking in terms of stature, in terms of star power as well?
Well, I think at this stage, I think he's just sort of trying to break out from being a tag team wrestler. And, I mean, he's shown a lot of promise, but he's still seen as the guy that was one half of the Rockers. So he's still got a little bit of work to go to being seen as the guy that's the next mid-card champion and then whatever going forward.
I think it was a big decision to put the IC title onto him. But I think just a general idea, I think, of WCW, they have this mentality, not much different to WWF at points, where their champion has got to be the huge guy with the bulging muscles or the big intimidating man. Shawn Michaels, he could be the greatest worker in the world right now. He'd be able to fight the champion maybe and get a very good match out of them, but I doubt they would ever put the big titles on him.
Let's flip it over now in terms of, obviously, Shawn, in theory, has left, although, as we say, Titan are still holding me up in terms of his release. On TV, at least, they said that there's going to be a 20-man battle royal to decide the two contenders for the Intercontinental title will face off the week after next for the title. Colin, in terms of guys who you might be able to pick out and go, there's a guy sitting waiting there who could be the next Intercontinental Champion. I mean, I think it's worth probably framing it by saying that we've got a heel WWF champion in Yokozuna. We've also been talking about how the Intercontinental title is kind of the workers' title. Who on the WWF roster, well, if anyone, stands out to you, Corin, as a guy who might be able to pick up that mantle and take over those matches?
Well, they're in a tough position now because, as we spoke about earlier, you've now also got the Quebecers, our tag team champions, also heels. So you'd end up, if Shawn Michaels was still in the company, we'd have had all three major titles being held by heels. I think it has to go on a face. But in terms of in-ring work, there's not too many people that could get to the level of Shawn Michaels. So if you go by popularity, then Razor Ramon is the only one that really comes to mind. If you really wanted to try and make somebody in a night, maybe the 1-2-3 kid.
Great.
Is it not quite sort of easy booking to book a feud between Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty? So let's have Marty Jannetty come in, take the Intercontinental title, and then have him and Shawn Michaels feeding a classic sort of former tag team partners against each other for the IC title. You'd get good matches. It seems easy, it seems obvious, and why not?
No, I mean, I think we go back to the match those two had together for the IC title. I think it was June or July. Probably the best match I've seen on Raw, certainly, since it started. In terms of, you know, two really good workers, a really nice long match. You two kind of stole my kind of picks in terms of the guys I had in my head, in terms of the 1-2-3 kid or Marty Jannetty. A proper wild card, Colin? Owen Hart?
I'm not sure that he's quite ready for a belt yet. He's another guy that's, I mean, he's coming from the Hart family, so he's got potential straight off the bat, but not sure he's ready just yet.
Craig?
It seems awfully consensual with Colin this evening, but Owen Hart's got to be a bit green, so not just yet. Maybe further down the line, but I think Colin and I's earlier shouts with the Razor Ramon 1-2-3 kid, Marty Jannetty, sort of field of competitors for the IC title, that's probably more realistic at this juncture.
Let's move on to ECW Ultra Clash. This is a show that happened a couple of weeks ago. Colin, if you'd start us off with the results.
Okay. The Public Enemy, Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge, defeated Jason Knight and Ian Rotten in a tag team match. Tony Stetson defeated Tommy Cairo in a singles match for the ECW Pennsylvania Championship. Super Destroyer 1 defeated Super Destroyer 2 in a mask versus mask match. The Dark Patriot defeated JT Smith in a scaffold match. The team of Terry Funk and Stan Hansen defeated Kevin Sullivan and Abdullah the Butcher by disqualification in a bunkhouse match. There was a battle royal in the women of ECW. Tigra won that. Sal Belomo defeated Richard Michaels in a strap match. Shane Douglas beat Sandman in a singles match for the ECW Heavyweight Championship. And in the main event, a baseball bat match, the Headhunters defeated Miguelito Perez and Crash the Terminator.
Craig, start us off with your kind of brief overall thoughts on the show before we get into the specifics.
It's difficult to shake off the feeling that it just looks like an independent show. It just looks like any sort of show you would see in a town hall with guys you largely hadn't heard of competing, invariably taking risks that are far too ridiculous for what they should be taking. And I know the match we're going to come back and discuss more in later detail, so we can move on. But it just seems a little bit over the top and just needless. I mean, if you were in the crowd, the small crowd that there was, you'd end up coming away thinking that the guys there had put on quite a good show for you. But if you were at all sort of subjective about it, you'd be wondering why they went to the extents that they did.
Colin?
Well, you say it looks like it's an indie show, Craig. It was in a bingo hall.
As far as I'm aware, to frame that, when they went off the air, they had midnight bingo about 2 hours later. just to frame all that, and it is that whole thing. I quite like that.
Did the WWF do that?
I'd have to ring up the Manhattan Center and find out. But that will be something a bit different, particularly with like a 1,500 person bingo event in the middle of the week.
I suspect that doesn't happen after Raw.
Colin?
Probably ballroom dancing at the Manhattan Center.
Something like that. Sorry, Colin, carry on.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy the show at all. I really didn't. I thought it was all so over the top, and the amount of, I'm don't get me wrong, wrestling's it's a bit violent, you know. There's guys beating each other up all night, but they just took it to another level. The amount of violent that was just unnecessary levels of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if you were to take some of this stuff in isolation, it'd be like, okay, that was a bit violent. Fair play, you know, that's what you want to do, and if you're an independent promotion, sometimes you're going to do stuff like that, that maybe if you're like WCW or the WWF, that you've got more controls, you've got people to answer to, you've got, you know, big things on the line, you've got TV contracts you can't do. But it was just one after another, after another, after another, and there was no remote element of pacing or selling in particular, or any kind of way of let's try and have one big moment. It was like, let's try and have one big moment every 5 minutes. And I thought, as a whole, and I think one of the things coming away from this, based on the reports, Colin, is that, well, and I didn't particularly enjoy the show either, for the reasons partly I've explained, and just, I think in part as well, just being a viewer, having only one camera is, particularly with that, if you've got to brawl over the arena, you need more than one camera, just so we can see what's going on. But in part, Colin, it seems like, while it may not have come across to the viewer very well, the people in the bingo hall seem to quite enjoy it.
Well, if you read what our friends over at The Observer have put out, people in the bingo hall absolutely loved it. Some even giving it a 5-star rating. Really doesn't come across on tape at all. I mean, the production values of ECW are awful. One camera in a hard position, and you how many brawls outside the ring, and not just outside the ring, and around the arena into the crowd did they need in one night? You need these things, you know, space it. Don't use it every single match. Make it special. Just don't have the ring. they were out there that often. They might as well have just stuck a square piece of concrete in the middle of the arena and just put them in there as a fight.
Craig?
I can't help but totally agree with what Colin just said. It does just seem like needless in this. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, if you were in the front row of that show and you saw a guy like just take unnecessary risks, you'd come away thinking that guy's put everything into this show, and you'd be like, well, that was quite a good night. But on reflection, you can't help. You look back and you just think that. What's the point in taking those risks? There doesn't seem to sort of be any need. You've got guys with sort of limited in-ring ability just taking stupid bumps just to cover for the fact that they can't do this stuff in the ring. That's simply what it looks like for ECW.
And I think I enjoyed so fractionally more than you guys did from the sound of things. But one other thing I'll bring up while we're talking about the show as a whole, before we touch on one or two of the matches, was that I lost count of the amount of moonsaults that were done in this show. I think it was 5, which is a lot, particularly as, like, it was 5, all done by guys who were over, like, 250 pounds. Like, one of the guys in the Public Enemy did it in the opener. There was one in the middle. There was two in the main event. And there was another one else somewhere else. It's like, overkill. Overkill.
In the main event, didn't you have Crash Terminator try to do one? And then one of those giant headhunters did one?
Yes, yes.
I mean, don't get me wrong. A guy the size of one of the headhunters doing moonsault was impressive. But when you've already seen it, like you said, 4 times before that, you think, oh, another moonsault.
I was just going to make 2 quite positive points about the pay-per-view.
I was going to ask you both at some point, is there anything you can bring away from this positively? Because we've been hammering at it, and I enjoyed some parts of it, but we'll come to that. Go on, Craig.
I was going to say, I think Joey Styles tells a good story. I think he's not...
That's the announcer, by the way, Joey Styles.
Sorry, yeah, the commentator. He's not given the best story to describe, but he still manages to take it and makes it look quite good. And I think hitting on what Colin just said, that he was talking about the headhunters attempting a moonsault, and if we can hark back 30 days until, or whatever, a month till our previous podcast, we were talking about how amazing it looked seeing someone like Vader hitting a moonsault. It's always awesome seeing a big guy hitting a moonsault, even if in the case of the headhunters it misses. So that looked quite good. That was quite good. But in terms of what was really good from the show, I think Joey Styles looks like a guy that we could probably turn quite average in-ring action into something that you would consider very impressive, and that's a talent in itself.
Colin, any positives for you from this show?
Well, you go on the fact of Joey Styles, the poor ECW commentator. I'd actually like to know where was he positioned? Do you know any idea where it's at?
Maybe next to the hard camera. That's kind of where I imagined him to be.
Yeah, because he was talking about things that we couldn't see because the camera was just, it couldn't find them, basically, because it wasn't where his position is. We couldn't see certain parts where they were fighting. Was there something I enjoyed? Terry Funk, Stan Hansen, Abdullah the Butcher, they're legends. You should enjoy seeing them. They all put in a great effort. Is that a good point? They obviously wanted to put on a good show for everybody. I just think that there was too many negatives for me to really pull any major positives out of the entire show.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And it kind of feels like that, as I say, if there was... I get the sense that there was a couple of ingredients here. As you say, you've got in Funk and Abdullah the Butcher and people like that, you've got big wrestling names here. I just thought it was all kind of framed all a bit wrong. Then there was the ECW title match was on kind of before the main event, which was weird. And then there was, and this is coming back to just, independent production values. There was at one point when I think one of the guys in the main event got thrown through the wall And the camera didn't pick it up, but it's like,
yeah, no.
From a TV perspective, if we'd have seen that, maybe that would have been, ooh, that's a bit different. Go on, Colin.
Personally, if I put my booking hat on, you surely, just for name value, would put Funk Hansen, Sullivan and Abdullah the Butcher in the main event. They must, surely that's your draw for the show.
Yep.
No,
absolutely.
I think I'd agree with that as well. There were a couple of things that I liked in terms of, you know, as I said, there was the pacing was a bit off at times, but I thought that there was a couple of times in this show, you can't do it that often, but there was a couple of times when one match would end, and okay, there were far too many post-match run-ins, which I could see to you, but a post-match run-in would then lead into the next match. I thought that was kind of unique, and you can't do it that often because, one, you'll water it down, and two, there isn't always much sense for a run-in. But I think in terms of a transition between one match and another, to have kind of one spill over to the other so that the audience is still engaged, I thought that was quite nice. I thought the tag match with Funk in the middle, from what we could see, looked like a decent match, one of the better ones on the card. There was the bizarre match of Super Destroyer 1 against Super Destroyer 2, which was confused by the fact that they looked exactly the same, acted exactly the same, and who do I cheer? Not only can I not tell them apart, who am I supposed to cheer for?
I'd like to just say that they weren't exactly the same. One was wearing arm tattles.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're fine. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
No mistake there.
In the high definition world of the ECW taping, I can definitely tell that apart.
And if you go on to that match, you've got the winner, Super Destroyer number one, then getting on the microphone saying he's now the only masked man in the ECW, which then the Dark Patriot came out in his mask and started to get himself involved.
Go on, Craig.
I was going to say, I mean, the Super Destroyer stuff was like classic tag team splitting up stuff. I mean, whilst it's in the current climate, maybe not the most original stuff, but it was doing what you've seen them wrestling for years gone by, and it was okay. I mean, I didn't dislike that match because you got the classic tag team on the ropes taking on each other, and whilst you then ended up with Dark Patriot, which Duke Gilbert under a pretty poor mask, but it was still something. It was okay. I thought that was all right, but it did just seem wrestling by numbers. You had your tag team splitting up and taking on each other. It was just, it didn't seem like there was too much effort going on to that.
One thing we haven't really touched upon, but I think we were going to discuss it separately, but we'll kind of just bolt it on and then do the full kind of show wrap up at the end of the part, was the scaffold match. Now we're going to talk about scaffold matches more generally in a minute, but from all the scaffold matches I've seen, this was an abysmal match, but I actually think this was one of the better scaffold matches I've seen, and we'll come on to the bump at the end and just how ridiculous scaffold matches can be. But and Colin, was this anything to make note of in terms of the match even before the finish?
Well, I think I said to you at the time when we was watching it, the only scaffold reference I'd ever seen was the Road Warriors, and you see Jim Cornette take the bump that Dunny's knees in. I don't get it personally. I don't understand why the scaffold is needed. I don't see what it adds. I mean, it adds the element of danger. You know, you have to be thrown off of the scaffold, but the end result there is surely injury. And if you guys are injured, you can't make money off of them. I just don't get it.
No, I think that was a very good assessment. Craig?
The thing that strikes me most about the scaffold match is you look at it and you think on face value that you're going to see this match, that you've got your massive spots, and but then in the end it's just a match that is really slow, and you've got your guys really walking in a laboured fashion
on the scaffold, obviously because of the risk of injury. I don't underestimate that, but it's just it just plays really badly because the guys are taking it so in fear of actual taking a real injury. It's just difficult to watch because it's such a laboured and slow way that they perceive through the match.
No, go, Colin.
The scaffold they had in that match as well was really scary to watch. I mean, it was swaying all over the place.
Yeah. No, that's true. If you're going to do a scaffold match, it needs build quality. I think you could sell that for a minimum. But as I say, like, we'll talk about scaffold match more generally in a minute, but I think to come back to the match itself, I mean, the best spot of the match was actually, ironically, wasn't really that much to do with the scaffold. There was, because the scaffold was pretty near the top of the bingo halls it was, and there was a steel pipe running like perpendicular right across from one side of the room to the other, and they set up a very nice spot of a hangman DDT that I think JT Smith took the move on, which I thought was quite nice. But as we say, I think, like, having seen a few scaffold matches, this was almost just as bad, but I think slightly better. The real kicker in amongst all this, Colin, and firstly to say that I don't know how JT Smith even was able to get up after this, given that he basically, rather than the standard scaffold finish, which is have someone dangling by their fingers, kick their fingers away, and they fall, you know, 10 feet or however, 15 feet, however big the drop is, JT Smith basically just ran off. And then landed kind of, well, I've heard very important stuff on his knee, on his side, on various different things. How he didn't do some significant damage to himself, I had no idea. And then the kicker to all this, and this comes back to kind of the top of the point in terms of just the whole show was manic and there wasn't really any, I think psychology is in the word for you so far, but there wasn't really any, was that in the minutes that followed, there was a brawl around the arena with JT Smith, who's just taken this, in theory, career-ending fall, is up, okay, on the losing side of the brawl. I will at least caveat that. But the whole thing, Colin, was just so strange in the way they finished the match.
Well, it's like the bump that he took should have done a lot more damage than it actually did. It didn't look good. I mean, he landed on his knees first. You even had Joey Styles on commentary telling everybody that could be his career over. And then almost as soon as Styles had finished his sentence, JT Smith was on his feet. And then a few seconds later, Patriot was down there with him, and they proceeded to brawl around the arena. Surely, one of the big points of a scaffold match is, I mean, is the bump at the end. You've lost, you've just fallen, I don't know, it's about 10 feet. In reality, it's not really that far, but he's just fallen from a scaffold. Surely you sell that, even if you do land properly and land on your feet and fall down. Even though he botched, well, he looked like he botched the fall, surely he has to stay on the ground and sell it.
Craig?
Colin's absolutely right. It's just, the idea of having like scaffold match and having anything afterwards just seems absolutely ridiculous. That should be the end. That should be the end point. The falling off the scaffold, that should be the finish. The idea of anything afterwards just seems beyond the realms of believability, to be honest.
No, I think you're right. And just to kind of quickly frame scaffold matches in general, I mean, and this isn't a good argument, but I'm trying to make one just for the sake of the match, but is there a sense that before you've seen a scaffold match, the idea of it does sound really good? Like, just like, wow, they're going to be 15, 20 feet in the air, and it's going to be the first person who falls off, and you kind of imagine this guy just flying to his death, kind of from 20 feet up in the air. There is, in theory, the visual that you can sell people before they've seen the match sounds quite good, but when you, the logistics of it just don't make sense. And I think once you've seen one, there is zero inclination to see another.
Yeah, if you've never seen one, and you're going to go to a show, your friend comes up to you and says, we're going to go and watch some wrestling tonight. And you arm and ar about it. Your friend turns around to you and says, there's a scaffold match. And instantly, what's one of those? Your friend proceeds to tell you that there's a scaffold set up over the ring with a platform 10, 15, 20 feet above the ring. And the idea is to throw your opponent off it. Instantly, you're going to be wondering, how is that going to work? I've got to see this. And then, unfortunately, you get to see it. You can't really do anything up there. And the bump at the end is awkward. And afterwards, you're left thinking, well, I didn't really see a guy fly off like I saw in my head, like a Superman dive off, crash into the mat in a blaze of glory. No, he just sort of falls off after dangling for a little while. I just don't see how they can work, really.
Craig, anything to add to that?
I feel extremely consensual in this regard, but Colin's absolutely right again. It's just, you watch a scaffold match and you've got your guy teetering on the brink, but in the slowest possible way imaginable. I mean, you watch the match and you expect, you take a scaffold match and you expect the guy to fall from it. You expect the incredible bump spot. That's what you imagine is going to happen. But you look at it, and you've got the guy take it, and the guy that's going to take the bump, and we've seen it with Burnett in the past from LOD, I believe, as well, that you've just got them, that they just seem, when they're about to take the bump, it just seems everything's just almost as if it's in slow motion. And I totally appreciate if you're going to take a bump off scaffold that it's going to be in the slowest way imaginable, but When you're watching it, it doesn't add anything to it, in the fact that it is just such a slow match, and it just seems awful. And when you've got your JT Smith taking, as he did, the bump off the scaffold knees first, there doesn't seem to be the amount of payoff that you'd expect from this type of match. I mean, don't get me wrong, as a guy that's a sort of quite a retro view of wrestling, I love the idea that you've got your traditional payoff of a steel cage match or whatever that is the traditional payoff of the match. It leads to a sort of stipulation match where something has to be brought in that brings the feud to an end. But when you take a scaffold match, it just slows the action down, and you know a big horrible bump's going to happen, and then you see it and you're just left shuddering rather than thinking that's great for business. It's awful. I hate a scaffold match. It just seems over the top and ridiculous, and everything that you don't want wrestling to be about. You want it to be about a guy taking something that that on the face of it seems like it should hurt, but it doesn't. But that's what wrestling's about. And then you see a guy falling off scaffolding knees first, and it just sort of counters that, in my opinion.
No, I think your both assessments was very good. The one thing I will say quickly before we kind of wrap up our thoughts on the show was that, as much as the scaffold match wasn't very good, I actually thought the use of the structure in a couple of the other matches actually probably helped it, just in terms of the fact it was so close to the ring, and not that people climbed on top, but people kind of climbed on the bit that people got in, and that kind of helped it a little bit. But yeah, I think on the whole, it's a scaffold match is a match that maybe you can sell people on once, but you will never sell them on twice. And that's not how wrestling draws money. It's not even like a magical idea. It's good, the actual concept. And as you said, Colin, the actual thing you can sell people in the head sounds quite good, but it's not great. And the payoff is so much worse, it just isn't worth it. Craig, your final wrap up on the show and a score rating.
Oh God, it's difficult. I mean, you take the tag matches and they were, I mean, I didn't enjoy the show, but I thought the tag matches were quite entertaining. So for in terms of entirely sitting on the fence, I would give this a 4 or 5 out of 10 as well. Just so it didn't fall below the WCW show, but it didn't better it either. That's how I'm feeling this season. Just totally sitting on the fence. So equal to WCW Brawl 93.
Colin?
I think Craig is being very generous. I'll try and be generous and give it a 3. Wasn't impressed at all.
Well, isn't this fascinating?
A 3 and a 5.
Well, you two hate the show more than I did, yet I'm giving it the worst rating of the three. which I don't know what that means. I don't know whether we need to kind of cut with a better scoring system, but I'm giving this show a 2.
I'm trying to be generous.
I'm not. but no, like, as we said, there was, to me, like, the fundamental, regardless, like, forget all the stuff with the extreme style and the scaffold match and all that, the fundamentals of wrestling you didn't hit here. No. You know, in terms of what, and let's almost forget the production stuff, and I know maybe that's, you know, part of a wrestling show is how does it come across to people on TV, or certainly how it is in 1993, maybe 20 or 30 years ago you wouldn't have said that. Well, you certainly wouldn't, given that TV wasn't really a big part of wrestling back then, but I can forgive the production stuff, although, as you say, you've only got one hard camera, you can't do all these arena-wide brawls. But I just thought some of the fundamental stuff of how you put together a two-hour wrestling show, you didn't meet. And for me, that was, you know, just a real big mistake. But the thing we have to caveat that whole thing was, the people in the arena, from what we hear, loved it. If you can get people in the arena that love your event and want to come back, regardless of whether it doesn't come off on TV very well, if you can get that atmosphere, then for a company like Eastern Championship Wrestling, that's not the worst thing. But no, I'll give it a 2. I don't think it was a very good show. I think there were a couple of small positives, but I just think, like, if you did the show opposite to this, it would be a lot better. Not regardless how it comes across, because it's your promotion you want to build, you want to be able to give a good TV product. I would certainly suggest to ECW get a second camera. But I think that if you're going to build a company of that size, it's, you want people in the arena to have a good time because they're going to come back. And regardless of how badly it came across to us, and quite badly as our score ratings, our review suggests, I think that's a positive they can take away. But I just think on the whole, if you can, there were so many things wrong with the show that I can't give it any higher than a 2. Let's go on to our final discussion point of today's show, which is about the NWA title, the NWA. Colin, as we talked about kind of in the news and briefly when we were talking about Full Brawl as well. Also, the NWA title has officially split from WCW. There are still some legal stuff going on in amongst that, WCW, you know, owning the physical belt being one of them. But I think for the NWA, yeah, we want to talk about an organisation that, as we said, goes back to the 1940s and for decades was the championship, was the guy. Does it feel to you, Colin, like now that, given the wrestling, you know, kind of landscape has changed now that rather than the territory system, which was what the NWA was built around, that has kind of disintegrated. Now we've got an organisation left with, one, without a title that doesn't have that much equity anymore, and two, that just isn't very relevant.
Well, it is exactly like you said. The NWA title was built around the territories. You had the champion voted for by committee, who would go from territory to territory, defending the title, drawing crowds. You know, you had the promotions able to promote the fact that they had the NWA World Champion come into their little corner of the globe. It was a draw. It is a draw. The NWA name itself is synonymous with wrestling. But now that they're not going to be linked with WCW, there is nobody in the landscape now that is going to give the NWA that spotlight. They're not going to get anything from the World Wrestling Federation. Without WCW, I can't see if the NWA can be taken seriously anymore.
Craig?
It's difficult to imagine, like Colin says, that the NWA being taken as a serious promotion now without serious investment. I mean, we can't dismiss the fact that their title's got a great lineage, and in a few years' time that there's going to clearly be a great book coming out on the history of the NWA title. But right now, without proper investment, proper money, and someone that's really going to want to take it forward, or a serious promotion that's
really looking to have the NWA associated with it. It's difficult to see that they can be taking anything other than anything that's other than a small indie promotion. That's what it is just now. I mean, you saw the during the 80s when the WWF expanded, the promotion's fallen by the wayside, and as it stands right now, can you see NWA as anything other than one of those various promotions like the AWA that fell by the wayside? You can't really see them as anything other than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Craig, just correct you, because I don't doubt that you know this, just to kind of just reframe it, is that, you know, the NWA isn't a promotion. It's not really a thing. It's kind of, it's a conglomeration of a lot of different...
Oh, no, absolutely, but I mean, when you take your WWF fan in 1993, as we're in just now, it's just, they don't see that as a serious threat, and in the same way that they probably don't see that the WCW in its current format is a serious promotion. That's the thing. It's just the sort of name recognition that NWA in 93 doesn't have the same name recognition that it did in the late 80s when you had Ric Flair at the top of the world when he was seen as the world champion.
I completely agree. I think what I was trying to say was that the NWA title and its relationship to the champion and the events it will be on is different to the WWF title, because the NWA is a sum of a group of parts. In terms of the group of parts of the promotions, and the strength of the NWA in part will live or die, or well, not quite like that, but it will fluctuate up and down depending on how strong its conglomerate parts are. And I think now it just isn't the case anymore, just because, as I said at the top, the wrestling landscape has changed. And I think the one thing that you could say for decades was that, what did the NWA Heavyweight Championship mean? It meant that you were the best wrestler in the world. And I don't think in 1993 that means that anymore. And I think that if it's not affiliated with the WWF and it's not affiliated with WCW, who is out there who isn't part of those groups? Because while it was on Ric Flair, you know, Flair is still one of the biggest names and one of the best wrestlers, certainly in North America. I can't speak for Japan. But, you know, without Flair having that thing, who can they turn to now and go, he's the guy who we could put on our shoulders? And what I mean when I say all that is that because the strength of the NWA is in the promoters, if there's no big events going around, you're not going to be able to sell it to a big name. And maybe like one of the better, like quote unquote, well, not independent, but maybe free agents is someone like Terry Funk. But given that Funk maybe isn't, and Funk's maybe not the best example, given that I think his career is winding down now. But who can you go to and say, this is the biggest championship, you're going to sell out all these arenas? Because the minute someone gets hot, they're not going to earn the money that they would do in one of the WCW or the WWF. And as a result, you're not going to keep hold of them. So as a result, the idea that someone like Lou Thayers and Harley Race and the Funks carried was that being the NWA heavyweight champion meant you were the best in the world at what you did. And that doesn't matter, Colin, anymore, I don't think.
No, I mean, it really is a shame. The history that the NWA Championship has is phenomenal. And if you think now, while they were affiliated with WCW, they could have the NWA world title on the likes of Ric Flair, on Vader, Sting, and now they're not going to be able to have that big name recognition. They could take the NWA title to an indie event somewhere in the States, and who's going to draw? Like you said, you could put it on a Terry Funk, who maybe is an independent now, but there isn't really a name draw anymore. That instantly you've gone from having your world championship on a Ric Flair to have just an example, which the name I'm going to pull is the Terminator guy off of the ECW that was in the main event against Headhunters. That you're going to go from a Ric Flair to somebody that you've never really heard of. Your credibility of the belt is going to drop instantly because you've gone from having a big name to someone that's only a few people have heard of in a certain part of the country working an indie show.
Craig?
Is that Colin's absolutely right again. I feel we're Colin and I are entirely consensual this evening. It is just that it's you look down the lineage of the NWA title and it's fantastic, but unless you've got this sort of breaking independent promotion, or you've got a guy that's loaded with money, like your Ted Turner or your Vince McMahon, that's willing to take an indie promotion or a regional promotion and really push it, it's difficult to see anything other than NWA being absolutely dead in terms of how it's perceived by the modern day wrestling fan. Unfortunately, I mean, as great a history as it has, I mean, is the NWA, is it relevant to the modern day wrestling fan? I don't think it is. You look through the history and we talked earlier on about the Intercontinental title being the workers' title, and I mean, you can look at the NWA title being the workers' title as well, but I mean, you look at it and who is it that could possibly be that on the independent circuit? And secondly, how could they make that title relevant? I think, first of all, it's difficult to find someone that would make the belt relevant, and secondly, I think it would be even more difficult for there to be a promotion that would make that relevant.
No, I think on the whole, I think that's kind of where the NWA is, and there's the whole thing about, you know, there was a meeting this month, and the NWA at one point had something like 26 different regional territories at its pomp. Now I think there was a meeting within the last month that was attended by 5 different promoters, which I think is just an illustration, one, that there just isn't that many territories anymore, and two, that not the interest in the NWA, that's the wrong way to put it, but kind of just like the value in it isn't that high anymore. And I think it will be a massive step to say that the NWA title could just stop soon, but if there's no, and maybe like an independent level, maybe it could continue, but if there's no one who's really willing to kind of, because I don't, as far as I'm aware, there's no NWA president at the moment. So we might be in kind of a bigger, and I don't really want to get onto that now because it could be here for ages, but there might be a bigger thing now, just whether the NWA full stop continues. But I just think we're at a crossroad now with that. To move away from that slightly and towards kind of where WCW stand with that, Colin, two questions. Firstly, can we consider the run of having two world champions on a WCW show a failure? And secondly, do you just see whatever they're calling it now, the Wrestling Heavyweight Championship, just being dissolved or unified into the WCW title?
They can't have two world champions. I mean, that's just not going to work. The main event champion is the world champion. You can't turn around and say, well, there's two guys, they've both got the world title. It just doesn't make any sense. So if the WCW have the physical NWA championship belt and their own, whatever they call it now, WCW International Championship belt, they have to merge them. I don't see a way around it. They can't keep the separate titles, because if they did that, it would only devalue the United States Championship, which would in turn devalue the TV title. It's not workable.
Call it, Craig, sorry?
It's also lazy booking. I mean, if you can't book a guy to be seen as a conceivable threat enough without a title, then you can't just hand him a title that means nothing. So, they have to have a major belt, your middle card belt, which, like your IC title, maybe the workers' belt, or vice versa, and your tag titles. That's all you really need. Any more than that, and it's just a case of booker laziness more than anything else.
No, I mean, having two world champions will never work. It literally makes no sense. Because the idea of the world champion is that guy is the best in the world. As I said about the NWA title, this is the guy. And it's like, no, this is the guy. And it's like, well,
you're absolutely right. Let's take it back a year, and you had your Ric Flair debuting in the WWF, and he was claiming to be the real world champion. That set up a proper angle. But, I mean, if it was just But it wasn't even taken at face value. I mean, you didn't have your Jack Tunney being like, oh no, you're right, Ric Flair's the real world champion. You had a sort of a, well, who is the real world champion, Ric Flair or Hulk Hogan? You can't have two world champions. It just, I mean, I'm sure it's great for house shows, but it's not great for wrestling generally.
No, I think the only way it works, well, it doesn't, the only way it happens is that you end up defining one under the other, which just completely just makes no sense to the idea of having two world champions. And, you know, it's like, maybe, I think the one thing that maybe you could say was, well, that they kind of kept Flair and Vader apart in the sense that we've got two guys that we can draw from. But other than that, I don't think it had any benefit. And I'm with you, Colin. I think the only way to do this is just to very quickly unify the titles, stop calling two different guys a world heavyweight champion and a WCW heavyweight champion, because which one's better? And the only...
You could get a draw out of it.
Yeah, no, you could.
I mean, you could get the next pay-per-view, you've got who's the real world champion, there's your draw, there's your tagline for your pay-per-view, sell some tickets. But after that, that's it, done.
End it. Completely. Anyway, that will we'll wrap up this week, so we've got a couple of things to come to, but that will wrap up the discussion part of the show. Craig, as we always do at the end of this month, and I get the sense there might be some pretty slim pickings here, your match of the month slash, and I don't know how quite I'm going to frame this yet, but all kind of the one thing that a person should go back and watch from this month.
It's pretty difficult, isn't it? I mean, I think the best stuff was probably the Quebecers versus the Steiners on Raw, either as the tag match or Scott versus Pierre the week following, or if you're of a WCW persuasion, I guess it would be the William Regal versus Ricky Steamboat match.
Stephen Regal. Ricky
Sorry.
Steamboat. Yeah.
Yep.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Of course. His manager's called William. It's an easy mistake to make.
Exactly. But the thing with that match is it was exactly what you would expect. You would expect two guys that were pretty solid in the ring to put on a solid match. So on that basis, and we talked about slim pickings, it would be the Quebec rules, Quebecers versus the Steiners for the tag titles. It wasn't great, but it really was the best match that you had this month, certainly on free TV.
Colin?
Worryingly, I'd have to say it was the Steiners as well. Worryingly, because now Scott's suspended, you've not got them on TV for a couple of months at least. So I'm worrying about next month. Where's our highlight going to come from?
We will wait and see. I don't have a positive match of the month because every good match this month ended in a dodgy finish, which to me just undercuts the whole thing, because to me that tells me that's a mean to an end or lazy booking. So my kind of moment to go back and watch is probably the scaffold match, just because you don't see that many of them for reasons we discussed. And of all the matches I've seen scaffold match wise, this was actually all right. And that's an indictment of the month we've been through. But I think that's where we're at. So I think we'll jump back in the time machine to 2013. Nothing to discuss this month, 2013 rise, but I figured I'd frame it like this. Colin, remind us where people can find you on Twitter.
At @C_Judders.
And Craig, Twitter and your blog.
Yeah, no worries. It's Craig W45. Sorry, can I start again? CraigW4584. I should remember my date of birth at twitter.com. And my blog is ringthedamnbell@wordpress.com.
Excellent, excellent. Next month, I think we've got an ECW event, ECW NWA Bloodfest. I think that's happening next week, actually. So I'll be live tweeting that. I don't know when. Raw as usual. We've got Halloween Havoc at the end of the month. And one thing I'm going to try and start live tweeting is not everyone, because it would just be stupid, but I'm going to try and do the odd ECW Hardcore TV and the odd WCW Worldwide as well, just to give people kind of a feel of what that was like back then. But anyway, that will wrap up this week's show. Big thank you to Colin Judkins.
Thank you very much.
Craig Wilson.
A pleasure as always.
And we'll be back next month. I don't know exactly when yet, but it will presumably be the end of the month. Anyway, I've been Bob Bamber. This has been episode 2 of the Wrestling 20s Ago podcast. And until next time, goodbye.